Hi, and welcome to the Sexy Aging Podcast. I'm Tracy Monoknuku, a midlifer, menopausal, and at the juncture of life where I decided that I was going to kick over my bucket list, starting with this podcast. Since then, I've written a book, My Menopause Memoir, set up a website to support women through the menopause transition, developed an online course for menopause, and thrown my passion for fitness and wellness into an app specifically made for women in midlife and menopause. I also love delivering workshops virtually and in person to support women in the workplace when it comes to, you guessed it, menopause. If you're interested in finding out more about these projects, I've added the links in my bio, and I offer podcast listener discounts in the show notes just for you, so check those out. As an indie podcaster, that means that no one is paying me to produce this podcast. I want to bring you relevant, interesting, and engaging guests. By following and sharing the podcast with others, I can continue to make the podcast episodes and give you more of what you want to listen to. So let's crack on with today's interview. If you're struggling with your menopause symptoms, weight gain, fatigue, joint pain, mood swings, and you're trying to figure out what you need to do to get your mojo back, I've got two professionally endorsed resources that can help you. The Sexy Aging Menopause Management Course is an online resource that breaks down all the information on menopause, what it is, what's happening to your body, and how to manage the symptoms through lifestyle hacks. Evidence-based information on movement, nutrition, stress reduction, the importance of sleep, rest, and recovery, as well as community and joy. Podcast listeners can access the discount to the course in the show notes. And my Sexy Aging Fitness and Lifestyle app that provides fitness and wellness programming specific to women in the menopause life stage. All the things. Workouts at the gym, workouts at home, short HIIT workouts, yoga for stress and sleep, specialized mobility, balance, agility and core workouts, plus nutrition and menopause management tips. There is a free 1 week trial and the link is in the show notes. I've done all the work for you, so your job is to tap into these tools, put the guidance into practice, and feel the difference. But from the US, Dr. Dina Amira, she is an evolutionary geneticist, teacher, and author of A Brief History of the Female Body, an evolutionary look at how and why the female form came to be. Dr. Dina is also a senior scientist at the Center for Reproductive Longevity and Equality at the Buck Institute of Aging. So yeah, that was a bit of a mouthful. And I think it's just going to be way more interesting to hear about you, Dr. Dina, from your perspective, like a little of your background and how you came to be working in evolutionary geneticism. Is that the thing?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you for having me on your podcast, Tracy. I'm really sort of heartened that the conversations about menopause are, you know, it's been such a taboo topic. And in the last, I don't know, five years, let's say, and really heating up in the last year, people are talking openly about this stage of life that so many women, half the world,
all the women, yeah.
All the women, yeah. You know, this is something that every woman goes through. So I'm so excited that we're having this conversation, that, you know, around the world, people are having this conversation. I think, you know, you mentioned my book. One of the reasons I wrote A Brief History of the Female Body is that I feel women deserve to know more about their bodies.
Yes, girl.
You know, and women deserve more research and research dollars spent on, you know, our bodies, what's happening in our bodies, how we can live healthier lives. You know, if we get sick, what is the best way to deal with it? So it's just, you know, it's one of the reasons I wrote my book. Now, my perspective, of course, is, you know, I'm an evolutionary biologist. So, you know, nothing I talk about really is prescriptive. Yeah. I just find it fascinating. And I feel strongly that sort of the evolutionary perspective is really important in the understanding of how our bodies work the way they do, and even how to treat them you know, in the best way. So I think, you know, the evolutionary component, it's not why I do what I do. I just think it's fascinating. I'm just really interested in why, how and why. Really, for me, it's the how, but the why is also fascinating. How and why do bodies evolve? You know, why? So, you know, I have a master's in anthropology. So I've always been interested in humans and human evolution. But in my master's degree, I sort of decided I was less interested in studying bones. So I went on a Neanderthal excavation and, you know, spent hours in the lab studying bones. But what I realized is that I'm just more interested in genes as a way to sort of study our past. And I also realized I'm actually more interested in sort of broader questions about how bodies evolve. So, you know, I'm interested in what's happened in humans, but I'm also really interested just generally in like, how do big changes in bodies happen, like at the genetic level? So after my master's, I did a PhD at Yale not in the anthropology department, but in the ecology and evolutionary biology department. And I worked with someone who was studying the endometrium, and he was asking some really interesting questions about, you know, how did pregnancy evolve? You know, we basically are mammals, and actually the very first mammals laid eggs. And so, you know, one of the questions we were really interested in is, well, how does a mammal go from laying eggs to growing babies inside their bodies? Like, that's a radical change.
So radical. Yeah.
How do those kinds of changes evolve? So I got really interested in the female reproductive system, and studied, like I said, pregnancy. I studied the evolution of periods, which involves the endometrium, the lining of the uterus. So I got really interested in those kinds of questions. And then I studied the brain. So, you know, after you get your PhD, people tend to then do a postdoc, which is just, you know, working in a different lab, answering usually a similar type of question, but maybe in a different system, or, you know, it's a chance to try something new. So I wasn't focused on female reproduction in my postdoctoral lab. I was focused on the brain, but very similar types of questions, like, you know, mammals have a neocortex, other types of animals don't. How did that happen? Like at the genetic level. And then while all of this was happening, I was having babies myself. So Actually the first idea for this book, A Brief History of the Female Body, came when I was doing my PhD. So I was studying the evolution of pregnancy, and I was actually pregnant with my first baby. And my mind was blown with some of the things that I was learning about, you know, why am I experiencing morning sickness? Why are there all these bad things that can happen? Like, pregnancy seems to just, you know, evolution is all about reproduction. It should just work. But, you know, humans have a really hard go of it. You know, so I was going through my pregnancy, and then I was also studying pregnancy, and it was like, I would stop myself, you know, I don't know, every day learning some new mind-blowing thing, saying other women need to know this, you know? And That was sort of, I mean, that was a while ago. So my oldest child is 13. But that was sort of when the kernel of the idea sort of popped up. And I have four kids. So, you know, it's my oldest is 13, my youngest is 4. So it's been a hard road. It's hard to be a scientist and, you know, have such a full family life. And so after my second postdoc, I also moved across the country with my husband and our three kids at the time. I thought, let me take a pause. I had this idea for a book, so I wrote my book. But as I was writing it, actually before I was writing it, I connected with the Buck Institute, which is this research institute on aging conveniently located 20 minutes from my house in Northern California. And so they were doing something really interesting. So they, you know, are broadly interested in aging, but they had gotten this huge pot of money from an investor very interested in female reproductive aging. So aging of the female reproductive system. And they shot this investor, shopped around, you know, looked at the Buck Institute and some other universities and decided this is where I want this center to be. And so it was kind of this awesome sort of serendipitous thing where I'm starting to write this book on the female body. I have sort of this unique perspective. They don't have a lot of, or any, I think at this point, evolutionary biologists who work there. So that's when I sort of started my relationship with the Buck. And I am soon going to be starting, you know, the process of research is very slow and you have to find money, but I'm looking for money to study not so much the evolution of menopause, but I'm very interested in how other animals have solved problems that humans have. So, you know, there are some species of whales, for example, there are some species of whales, we'll probably get into this, that experience menopause the way we do. I'm actually more interested in the species that have very long lifespans, but don't experience menopause.
Yeah.
So bowhead whales, as an example, live until they're 200, let's say. And as far as we know, they don't go through menopause. And, you know, there are some folks who have looked carefully at their ovaries. Of course, whales are hard to study. You know, they're hard to follow. But, you know, we have some fancy tricks. So you can look in their ovaries and see evidence that they're still ovulating, like up to the, you know, up till like 150, you know, incredible. Some like phenomenal yeah. number. Which I think is really not just intellectually, I'm interested in that, but also that, you know, species like that could hold, you know, the answer for perhaps extending reproductive longevity in humans, which, you know, a lot of people have strong opinions about, but, you know, if there were a way to do it, I find that, you know, a lot of people study lab animals, which is amazing. You know, you can manipulate them in exactly the way that you want. They're all genetically very similar, so you don't have to worry about differences in genetics. But, you know, lab animals are not humans. And, you know, many interventions that work in, let's say, mice don't work in humans. And so I'm more interested in sort of looking at what's happening in nature. To see how some animals have solved some of the problems that we face.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that was, sorry.
You got me firing. No, I've got questions because I'm like listening to what you're saying and I am fired up for the questions that I want to ask you specifically on menopause, because you've talked about fertility and reproduction and I think that's a whole other conversation, which is also really fascinating. I want to touch on the menopause part which you have a whole chapter dedicated in your book. For the listeners, I'll put the links in the show notes so that they can also look and potentially find when they can get a copy. So we're looking at the relationship between evolution and menopause. My questions: what's the purpose of menopause? Like,
yeah,
why is it happening for humans? I mean, I'm spending quite a lot of time in this space having conversations around it being a complete shit show and yes. how difficult it is for women and how little information we have, how uneducated many of our local doctors are, not their fault all the time, just they haven't had the education. So, you know, we're coming to the stage of Gen Xers, I'm one, who are very loud saying, why do we not have information on this? And why is this happening to my body and nobody told me about it? So from your perspective, can you share or shed a light on, you know, why are we actually going through this?
Yes. I mean, so it's a hard question to answer. I think there's a lot of components of it. There are some things that we know, okay? So like at a very basic level, why do we go through menopause? One answer is, well, we go through it because we run out of eggs. So, you know, I think that that's sort of the first thing that we have to talk about. You know, something that's obvious to most women is that, you know, we have this time period that we're able to reproduce and then we can't anymore. And that's very different from men. Men continue making sperm throughout their life. And, you know, again, at the most basic level, the reason we go through menopause is that we run out of eggs. So we make all our eggs when we're, you know, during fetal development. It's a very big number. So, you know, we think the maximum number of eggs that a fetus makes is like 7 million. So that's a lot of eggs because, you know, you think about how many eggs a woman would sort of ovulate during her reproductive years. And it's, you know, it's something like 400 or 500. So, you know, where do all the other eggs go? So that's an interesting question. But you know, again, back to that basic fact is we make all our eggs up front and then we lose the ability to make any more. So, you know, we lose basically the stem cells that replenish eggs. Men don't do that.
Oh, men, that's the difference then, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Men retain the stem cells. And so they are able, after they hit puberty, they're able to continue making sperm until old age. Now, you know, they have problems with their sperm as they get older. I mean, it's not, you know, a perfect world for them either, but they don't lose the ability to make sperm. Whereas we have this like fixed supply and the supply runs out. So, you know, that's kind of fact number one. Fact number two, and, you know, I think of all of these things from the perspective of, you know, evolution. So usually the first thing I do when I'm looking at a trait is I say, well, who else, you know, has the trait of interest? You know, are we the only ones? You know, because you hear that humans are unique in having menopause. It's a little more complex than that. We're not totally unique. But, you know, getting back to, we make this sort of basket of eggs up front and then we don't touch it after we're born. Like we cannot continue making eggs. So all mammals do that. We're not the only ones who do that. That's like a very ancient trait. And actually all birds do that too. So we make these eggs and then that's it. They have to basically survive and be enough for the rest of our lives. And, you know, there's, I think, a really interesting idea on why there's this big difference. So why do we make our eggs up front? And why do male mammals and male birds like have these stem cells that can keep making the sperm? You know, the most reasonable idea is female mammals, including humans, female mammals and birds, we invest a lot in reproduction. You know, you think about the life of a female mammal, like, you know, a mouse or an elephant, you know, all of the mammals that, that exist on the planet now and who existed in the past, a female is making these bigger sex cells. So she's making eggs. When you compare an egg to a sperm, like you already see this humongous difference in investment. The egg is this big, plump, huge cell, and a sperm is this tiny little thing, right? Mm. You can make millions of eggs, billions of eggs for the same amount of energy that it takes to make one egg. So that just there, just in making those cells, there's this huge difference in investment. But then a mammal gets pregnant, carries a pregnancy, that's many months where she's not doing anything else. a mammal is nursing her offspring, that takes a long time. A male mammal is not doing any of that. And, yeah, you know, probably isn't involved in caregiving. So we actually think that making all your eggs up front is a it's almost a system of quality control, because, you know, the problem with continuing to make your sperm is that they start developing, accumulating these mutations, and mutations are bad. You know, so it's, it makes more sense almost to sort of make your pile up front and try to keep them around for as long as possible. That's not an easy task either. We'll get into that. It, versus, you know, continuing to make sperm. And because as you continue to make sperm, they develop all sorts of mutations. For a male mammal that's not doing anything to care for the offspring, it doesn't really matter. But for a female mammal, she is trying to invest in offspring that are going to make it, you know, because she's investing months, years. A primate is investing years. An elephant is investing years in each baby. And so, you know, this is, in my opinion, sort of the earliest form of, you know, it's like a quality control, quality checkpoint, you know, like let's make sure that our eggs are as healthy as possible. And that's one of the reasons we make so many, and so many of them die. It's like our bodies are going through, and the ones that aren't of good enough quality, many of them, not all of them, because we're losing so many and we don't know exactly what's happening, but we know that some of them we lose because they're not good enough. And that is really important, again, for a female or male, any, if you're investing a lot in your offspring, whether it's, whether that individual is female or male, it just tends to be females in most species. Individual species will evolve ways to try and direct investment to, you know, the eggs, the embryos, the babies, the children that are going to make it. Okay, so sorry, I know I'm sort of going off on all these tangents, but these things are important when you try and understand menopause in our species. So basically, any female mammal that lives a very long time will go through menopause. So in that sense, it is not totally unique to our species, you know, and animals in captivity often will live, you know, beyond their egg supply. But in the wilds, so it's, you know, a great way to think about this is in chimpanzees. So
I was going to ask about that. It was right on the top of my tongue. What about primates? They're the closest thing in DNA to us. Do they have the same experience? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, chimpanzees are great because they're our closest primate relatives. They go through menopause at 50. The reason we tend to not think of it as menopause is that most of them aren't living, they're not even living to that age in the wild. So in the wild, most chimps will die in their 30s, 40s, maybe some in their 50s, but they're not living very long beyond the age of menopause. So we don't, it's not actually menopause that's so surprising in our species, because any animal, any female mammal that lives long enough will run out of eggs eventually. So what's unique in humans, like looking at the primates, is that we live so many years beyond menopause. And so that's the big question in primates is, you know, some will argue actually menopause didn't really evolve. We inherited menopause, and what evolved is how long we live beyond menopause.
So that's the evolution of the human race, really, isn't it? It's just that we're just living longer, and now we're like, okay, many of us are challenged by menopause symptoms, and how long is this going to go on for? So we're just kind of finding out the answer to that. And like you mentioned it right at the beginning, there just hasn't been the research or the funding to give us definitive answers to what to expect, right?
I'm hopeful that things are changing in the right direction on that.
I feel like things are changing. Like you mentioned, people talking about it in the last year, the acceleration of the conversation. It's definitely happening here in New Zealand as well. And of course, the medical support that's offered to women if they want to take that route. So we're getting somewhere, but I still have questions about the past and the evolution.
Yes.
You know, why are we here and what can we expect? I have a quick question for you now. Does environment and lifestyle affect your menopause or your experience? And we didn't actually speak about this in advance. I just am thinking about, does your environment affect your experience?
Yes. Genetics is probably the biggest player, but absolutely lifestyle, environment plays a role, not just in when you go through menopause, but also how you experience menopause. So I think the genetics is easier to understand. I think the environment and lifestyle factors, are harder to tease apart, and it's harder to pinpoint, because many of the factors go together. So, probably the most solid correlation between age at menopause and, some environmental factor is smoking. So women who smoke hit menopause earlier. And, it's not surprising, tobacco toxins are really bad for our follicles, which are the little homes for our eggs. There are also, studies showing that women from certain parts of the world, developing countries in particular, hit menopause a little bit earlier. But we don't know, is that because, their genetics are slightly different, or is it something different about lifestyle? I would say definitely it plays a role, but we don't know, we don't have all the answers. I think that we probably experience menopause differently than our human ancestors thousands of years ago. I think diet and sort of our physical activity levels have a lot to do with that. So there have been plenty of studies on, populations that, maybe live closer to the way that our ancestors would have lived. So hunter-gatherer groups. And, those types of populations don't report the same level of, symptoms during the transition to menopause. There is this one study on Mayan women. So, their estrogen levels go down at menopause, of course, their bone mineral density goes down, but they don't seem to experience more fractures. And, that's probably because of the way they're living. I mean, we're all told as we hit, our 40, the time around menopause, that strength training is really important.
100%. It's like, I'm all about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, those Mayan women are still, they're still lifting heavy things, and, they're in their daily life. This is, it's not like they're going to the gym and strength training, but, their lifestyle incorporates, using their muscles and, all of that into their daily life. So, I certainly think that the way we're experiencing menopause now is different than, how it would have been experienced from our ancestors, for sure.
Yeah. So talking about our experiences and menopause being different, what about your mum's menopause? Have you ever had a conversation with your mum about her menopause? Because I don't remember having a conversation, but I distinctly remember thinking back and reflecting on her experience. I could see it in front of me, but had no idea what it was. How about you?
Yeah, that's a great question. My mom, my goodness, I was older when my mom was going through menopause, because she had me when I was quite young. When she was quite young, excuse me, she was in her early 20s. So I do have memories of, her sticking her head in the freezer, the fans, the hand fans. But it's interesting, even though I was older, I mean, I must have been in high school, or, I was old enough to understand what was happening, but we didn't talk about it. And I don't know if that was cultural. So my family is Egyptian. So, I was born and raised in the US, but, my mom grew up in Egypt. And so I, there are some interesting cultural differences, and I'm not sure if that's one of them. But we did not talk about it. It was not, you know, other than my observations, you know, I remember, I have a very distinct memory of her just being so emotional one day and just lying in bed and crying. And that was so unlike her. She's such a strong go-getter, like no nonsense woman. And I remember not knowing what to do, not understanding why, but now looking back, I think that must have been, you know, all the hormonal chaos that she was experiencing. But no, there was no conversation. And, you know, I'm 45 now, so it hasn't started for me yet. But I don't think that my mom is gonna broach the topic with me.
That's interesting, eh? Because I never had a conversation with my mom either. And I remember very similar symptoms and scenarios that you described. And it's only because I'm now talking about my menopause all the time, like 24/7, that my mom is totally behind it. And she wants to talk about it. And she shares, you know, podcast episodes with her friends to share with their daughters, you know. So it's
fantastic.
It is fantastic. But in hindsight, it's like, I just wish that when we had the period talk, we had the perimenopause talk as well. You know, just the whole conversation. So, you know, leaving out some of the important chapters is not serving us.
I mean, it's so interesting. Really, menopause is sort of the equivalent of puberty. And there is this celebration, you know, even in my culture, like there's this celebration around your first period. And it's, you know, this rite of passage, you're becoming a woman. But there is, I mean, maybe in some cultures, there is something similar, but I think in most, there isn't. And the education, you know, in school, there is, I have had two kids go through puberty education, you know, it's something that they're talking about, even if they don't want to be. something they're learning about, but there isn't that equivalent, you know, level of education around menopause in sort of a systematic way. We're not in school when we're, you know, going through menopause. So how do you do it? But I came across this really interesting statistic the other day that only 20% of medical, so the obvious people we would talk to about it is our doctors.
Doctor, yeah. I know what you're about to say.
Yes, but you know, menopause isn't in the curriculum at most medical schools, which is just kind of unbelievable. Yeah. It's kind of unbelievable.
Yeah.
I again, like going back to, like, I am heartened. I think that, you know, things are changing. And I think, you know, people like you and other women who are vocal, you know, very vocal about this life stage, I think it's, things are changing for the better.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. So I'm part of a collaborative here in New Zealand. We're about 10 women across different industries. And we've come together to sort of pull together some content and information to present to our government and our health initiative here in New Zealand to ensure that education is improved around this topic. And also, you know, just support in the workplace. So we're all working behind the scenes to really shift the needle for women in New Zealand and the support that they require around menopause, because we've had enough.
I mean, I think that's fantastic. And, you know, women, it's just not fair, right? Career-wise, like we... you know, for me, I've been having kids for a long time. So, you know, it wasn't that I was so old when I started, but I had my last kid at 40. And so I'm in this unique, and it's not me, it's not unique. Like, you know, women are having their last child later and later.
Yeah. I had my son at 42.
Yes. So, you know what I'm talking about. Mm. And so, you know, you quickly go from, and they know how to take good care of us at the OBG, you know, the OBGYN offices when we're having a baby. They know what to do. And we're having all the right conversations. But, you know, the shift happens kind of quick for women who are having babies in their 40s. All of a sudden, you know, you're breastfeeding your child and then you're experiencing hot flashes. And it's just so fast.
Yeah.
you're also, you know, going through this really emotional, you know, physical, chaotic time while you have these young kids.
Yeah, this is my experience exactly. I mean, nobody has expressed it on a podcast episode previous to you about that real challenge when you have a child in your 40s and how it almost feels like your hormones never quite recover before they go into perimenopause, or you'll start to notice the little symptoms if you know what to look out for. But we don't get that information, and therefore you just feel like, oh, it's because I'm an older mother that I can't deal with this as easy as, you know, the first or the second one. So it was really, I feel like our hormones really aren't resetting to that level pre-pregnancy. You are going to struggle. It's going to be challenging. And lots of women are having children in their 40s. And I think that actually needs to be part of the conversation, which is, hey, look, something to take into consideration. This is going to happen.
Yes. You know? Yes. Yeah. The only question at my last doctor's appointment, the only question I was asked was, do you still get your periods?
Yeah.
That was it. I mean, that was the extent of, you know, the Same. Conversation about perimenopause.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a, you know, it's a hard decade for women, you know, especially if you have young kids, and especially if you're also thinking about your aging parents. It's like, you know, we're sandwiched between, you know, these two generations, and we're also, you know, hormonally going stressed. Through a lot.
I'm just gonna give it that word, stress.
Stress.
We're still, you know, sandwiched between everyone and trying to also build on our careers. It's like, I just have to applaud women going through this stage of life, holding it together. Many of us not holding it together, but supporting one another anyway, because we understand how challenging it is. And we'll come through it and it'll be amazing. I have a question, and I don't actually know if you'll be able to answer this, but I'm really curious as to your perspective. As our lifespan increases, will our reproductive system adjust?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. You know, a lot of people, so the age at menopause has really not budged a lot, you know, as opposed to lifespan, which has. I mean, lifespan has increased. I think the numbers are a little bit misleading on lifespan. You know, like you'll hear, oh, you know, people used to live, you know, into their 40s a century ago, and now it's, you know, into their 80s. You know, the problem with that is these are averages, and a lot of kids used to die young. So, so it's misleading. It's not like most people used to live until 40 and, you know, a century ago, and now people are living into their 80s and 90s. It's, you know, life expectancy has gone up, but a big reason for that huge bump in number is that less kids are dying. And so that is one, you know, because of, you know, vaccines and antibiotics and, you know, modern medicine has definitely, you know, bumped up life expectancy, but people have been living longer lives actually for a long time. It's not just this phenomenon of, you know, the last 100 years. And there's all sorts of analyses and evidence that it's really been, we don't know exactly when our longer lives evolve, but this is like a deep part of human evolution. It's, you know, tens of thousands of years, maybe hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even longer than that. And of course, it didn't happen overnight. But going back to your question, age at menopause hasn't changed that much. But, you know, people have this misconception that humans aren't still evolving, or, you know, I'm not sure what people think about that, you know, because of modern medicine. Oh, you know, evolution isn't still happening because, you know, medicine is letting everyone survive. But evolution and natural selection, if you remember the term from, you know, biology class, it's not about survival, really. It's about reproduction. It's about who is having more kids. And there are some people who are having more kids. And You know, if that's a trait that is encoded genetically, in theory, the age of menopause could change. And actually, there was a study from, I want to say 10 years ago, that took this, there's this big data set, it's called the Framingham Heart Study. And they followed women, it started in like the 1940s, and they've been following women, you know, over generations, and asked this specific question, are humans still evolving? And of course, this is a tiny subset of the human population, but what they found is, it is. And they predicted, it was super interesting, they predicted that future generations of this population of humans will be slightly shorter, slightly more stout, have slightly lower blood pressure, I think slightly lower cholesterol, and slightly longer reproductive lifespans. So meaning having first period a little earlier 10, and having 11. Menopause a little later.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, the differences are so slight, and we really need to look, you know, at a larger cohort of people and for follow them for a longer time to really get a sense of whether this is, you know, true or not. But it's absolutely possible. It's just, you know, we have we're looking at such a small window of all of, you know, all of the time that humans have been on the planet and all the time that animals have been on the planet. This is like a tiny little blip, you know? So it's not that surprising that, you know, if you saw the age of menopause changing, that it would be super slight, because this is just a tiny window in time. But absolutely, it is possible. And there, you know, are examples of somewhat recent evolution of other traits, you know, so possible, yes, maybe some evidence of it, certainly nothing that's gonna, you know, be obvious in our daughters' lifetimes or our granddaughter. Okay. You know, I mean, this, you know, these changes are very, very small, like a month difference perhaps, right, you know, over a couple generations.
Okay.
Definitely possible, though. I mean, the age of menopause, like I think I mentioned earlier, is mostly genetically determined. Like, you know, it's the age that your mother experienced menopause is going to be, you know, pretty close to when you're going to experience menopause. Now, of course, environment and other factors are playing a role.
Like surgery. Very yes. Hard to figure out when you're going to go into menopause if your mum has a surgical hysterectomy or oophorectomy, yes, right?
So and many women have this surgery. Yeah, so
it's really yes. quite common. Yeah.
One last thing on genetics and age at menopause. There are some really cool big studies on trying to find associations between places in our genomes and the age that women experience menopause. And one of the connections that is coming out of these studies is that women who reach menopause later seem to have better functioning. We don't know, but there seems to be a connection between genes in that repair DNA. So, okay, you know, our eggs and other cells in our body become damaged over yeah. time. I mean, that's just a fact of life, a fact of aging. And there seems to be this connection between a later age at menopause, because there is variation in age at menopause. Some mm-hmm. women don't go through menopause until they're 60. That's not that common, but it's there in the human population. There are some women that just reach menopause much later. And one of the reasons we think that is the case is that their bodies perhaps are repairing the DNA of their eggs more effectively. And so those eggs aren't being weeded out as eggs that aren't good enough to, you know, to ovulate.
So they continue to ovulate, therefore they're not going through menopause.
Exactly. Like if you can keep your egg supply healthy for longer, then you will go through menopause later because you haven't. I mean, we go through menopause, not when we run out of eggs, but when we don't have enough eggs anymore to produce enough hormones to maintain our cycles.
Yeah. Cause we just want the hormones.
Yeah.
Cause then life would be good if we just keep the hormones. Yeah.
Yes. And that is, you know, obviously one solution of keeping the hormones around is, you know, taking hormone replacement therapy. But there's definitely a movement of scientists, like, you know, at this Buck Institute, Center for Reproductive Longevity and Equality that I'm part of, trying to understand ways of keeping our ovaries healthy for longer so that they're, you know, we're being exposed to our own natural hormones, you know.
Yeah,
basically.
Sounds amazing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't take a patch, you would, you would, you know, maybe have some intervention, or, you know, the possibilities are, we don't know all of the possibilities yet. And it's like in a hot active area of research, but I think the goal would be, is there a way to keep our ovaries and the eggs within them healthier for longer so that we're just naturally continuing to produce those reproductive hormones, like keep us healthy. I mean, you know, we know that after menopause, I'm sure you've talked about this on your podcast. We know that once estrogen levels wane, you know, women experience, you know, not just bothersome symptoms, but also, you know, their risk for so many diseases.
Yeah, health challenges. Yeah. I'm going to wrap up today's interview, which has been fascinating. And now I'm also putting a pin somewhere in my head that says follow up on that study around maintaining your ovaries for the future. So I'll come back to you on that one. But you did write a really great article for the Boston Globe. I'm just going to quote you here. "There is one thing I'm certain of from my studies of the animal world as an evolutionary biologist. Women won't stop fighting for control over their bodies and will continue making reproductive choices no matter the obstacle." Can you just give us one last insight based off that quote? And yeah, my work here is done.
Sure. I mean, I was inspired to write that article after the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
I wasn't going to say anything, but yeah, thank you.
And really, you know, I try and stay out of the politics. It's just that when I see something like that happen, I can't help, again, like coming from my perspective as an evolutionary biologist, I can't help but want to teach people or tell people or remind people about reproductive choice in the animal kingdom, because, you know, the impression is that, you know, women who want to, you know, have choices about their bodies, about when and how they reproduce, you know, that's like, you know, some fringe group, or like a, you know, not the majority of women. And it's not just the majority of women. I guess my point of the article is that reproductive choice is like incredibly, it's like the core of our biology, not just human biology, but it is the core of mammalian biology, female mammalian biology. And it goes back to some of the topics that we talked about in, you know, in this podcast. Females invest a lot in reproduction. And so our bodies and our brains have evolved many, many different strategies to, for choice, mm-hmm. and at different levels. So not just like choice of which embryo to keep, as an example. And our bodies actually do that naturally. There's like this natural quality control of embryos that's happening. But, you know, at many different levels, the choice of who we want to reproduce with, the choice of which egg. So it is, you know, as I think about it, it's, you know, it's reproductive choice is the equivalent of eating, sleeping. You know, the females that evolved choice are the females who became our ancestors. And I'm not talking about our human ancestors. I'm talking about our mammalian ancestors. So those females who developed, you know, whether it's a behavior or actually a a change in their physiology
and survival mechanism as well, like, you know, choosing whether to have a pregnancy or not. As a mammal, they actually have those choices, don't they? Like, you know, if they're feeling that their environment is risky, for example, the primates in Borneo, the environment is risky, they're chopping down the trees or they're firing up the forest, it's probably not a good time to have a pregnancy. That is like a natural choice, isn't it?
Absolutely. Just the choice of when to go through puberty. I mean, that is very, I mean, obviously a female primate or a female mouse or, you know, whoever you want to talk about, they're obviously not consciously making the choice, but it's like it's part of our biology is that those choices are being made. And, you know, I view, you know, the choice that we're talking about in humans is just a natural extension of those choices that we have been making literally for hundreds of millions, you know, even longer than that, of years. So it's, I think, I think it's, you know, a lost cause. It's like, it's just too important for women. And I don't think they're going to easily give up that right. And they will make choices whether or not they are allowed to, or, you know, regardless of how hard it is, like they will be making those choices.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting times, Dina.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for your time on the podcast. I love this type of conversation, the science, the genetics, the DNA, like everything. It just gets my brain fired up. And thank you for answering my questions.
Yeah, thank you for having me on this podcast, Tracy. I had a great time, and continue the good work.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. I'd love to hear what you thought, so feel free to answer in the questions in Spotify or give your feedback in Apple Podcasts, and follow the podcast so you'll receive notifications for new episodes. And stay sexy.